I was just told by a sister that I should make myself comfortable on the one hand, and that my tai was a pagan instrument. And the sister, who shall remain nameless, was embarrassed once before with this same story from the platform. However, what I want to go into this evening is to sort of sketch out the prophet Ezekiel yet again, and then move into aspects of Ezekiel that really fit today's world. The prophets, by and large, are laid out sequentially. Jeremiah seems to be the only real exception to that, for Jeremiah's prophecy hops around quite a bit in time and space. But the others all have very good reasons. They follow a temporal pathway, and they raise an argument systematically, so that you get from the beginning of the prophecy, you come out at the end, and an argument has been completed within the sphere of the book that you have read. That's true of Jeremiah as well, even though, as I say, Jeremiah hops around and then moves a little further on into something which should have been sequential and then comes back and tacks a piece on the beginning and so forth. But even so, there is a systematic argument even in Jeremiah, even though he doesn't follow that strict temporal background. Ezekiel seems to follow this. And Ezekiel also raises and develops an argument which starts with Ezekiel being in Babylon in a condition of virtual slavery, having lost all of his freedoms and all of his things which were firm within his life, and then finding himself in that situation. But from that, he develops, through the trials, the difficulties that he and his fellow countrymen were experiencing, he develops to a vision of the future, which we still look forward to, and we look forward to with great anticipation. So I want to quickly recap where we have been in the past. Look a little bit at the earlier chapters in Ezekiel, and then start in chapter 17 and develop ideas which really fit into today's world. So we find in the very beginnings that Ezekiel is in Babylon. He's beside a river, and we know the name of that river, and in point of fact, it wasn't a river so much as an irrigation canal. It was part of the agricultural basis which had been developed by people before the Babylonians, and which was maintained and expanded by the Babylonian Empire, and then in due course formed part of the Persian Empire. This agricultural treasure, we might say today, which was the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, was maintained through a system of canals so that the irrigation was expanded, and then crops could be grown on an ever-increasing land base. It was way ahead of its time in many ways. The ancients certainly knew, the Egyptians also were very good at developing irrigation systems and expanding the area that they could bring under crops. That's a little bit of an aside to what's going on here, but it does indicate that Ezekiel had gone into a progressive, a competent, a forward-looking society. Now, this point is interesting, and it's important because we keep coming back to it as we work our way through this prophecy. Everybody thinks of themselves in modern terms. Everybody, Ezekiel and his contemporaries, all thought of themselves as being progressive, socially progressive, we say nowadays. They all thought of themselves as having solved the world's problems and having developed a better society for the way they thought, the way they acted, and for the things which they had developed within their society. And yet, when we look at what Ezekiel said about the changes that were going on, it's quite apparent that God did not share that view. So, Ezekiel, when we find him in the river Kibar, was visited in vision by God. Now, that was something which would not have been expected by the Babylonians. That was something which would not have been expected by the other captives which were there, and there were people from Lebanon, from present-day Syria, from what we consider Jordan nowadays. The Edomites and people like that were all there. We have lists in the Babylonian Chronicles of people that had been taken into Babylon with these successive military campaigns which the Babylonian army took throughout the Middle East. We know that there were many more people than just the Judeans, and that we know many of their names. And none of these other people would have expected to be visited by their God in that foreign land. And the reason for that was that the God controlled the land that the people belonged with. We see examples of this in the discourse between the Israelites and the Philistines, when the Israelites took the Ark of the Covenant into battle, and the Philistines said, "Their God's coming into our territory," in so many words. And so they had to steel themselves, because now they weren't just fighting a bunch of people, they were also fighting their God. That was the mindset. God belongs with that group of people in that particular land. But what this said when Ezekiel was visited by God in Babylon was that God was not restricted to the land of Judea. This was the statement made in Genesis, that God had formed the world. This is a statement made in many of the Psalms, that God controls the earth and man upon it. Isaiah said the same thing. Ezekiel didn't speak it in those words, but there it was, that God is not restricted to the land of Judea. The whole earth belongs to him. And if, in the words of Paul, if we would seek after him, we can find him wherever we are, under whatever circumstances we find ourselves today. And Ezekiel is witness to that fact. So that's the striking point which we come to in this first chapter. It's repeated in chapters 2 and 3. When we get into chapter 4, we start dealing with sort of charades and pictorial descriptions. And Ezekiel is saying to these people, look, you've seen what the Babylonians did to Jerusalem already. It's not finished. It's not finished, said Ezekiel. It's going to get worse. And all the people that came and listened to Ezekiel, and we have this many times as we work our way through the first 24 chapters, they all came to him and said, in so many words, he's speaking through his hat. He speaks to us in parables, it says at the end of the 22nd chapter. He's not got it right. And again, he speaks of things which are a long way ahead. That's also here in this first half of Ezekiel. They didn't believe him. And yet, it's very graphically demonstrated what had happened, and Ezekiel told them it's not finished yet. When we get through chapters 6 and 7, it's just sort of repeated that what was being spoken against the Israelites. Chapter 8 is interesting because chapter 8 lists a whole series of things which were going on in the temple. And if you remember from two talks back, we mentioned that Kathleen Kenyon in the 60s had been excavating in Jerusalem, and she had found right up tight against the temple wall a sort of grotto, what appeared to be a cave. And within that cave, there were somewhat more than 311, if I remember the number correctly, 311 little idols, little effigies, which were essentially fertility cult effigies, which were there right up against the wall of the temple in this little grotto. Now, Kathleen Kenyon's interpretation of this was that what was going on right close to the temple was exactly what is mentioned here in Ezekiel, that there were all kinds of things other than the worship of God going on in the temple itself. Others more recently have suggested that possibly it was a case of something like the reforms of Josiah, and there were one or two of these that went to, we have them in the various times in the Book of Kings, that somebody had dug a hole, made a little sort of cave, as it were, dumped all these things in, which we were getting rid of them, and covered it over afterwards. It's difficult to know who was right. But nonetheless, what the Kathleen's discovery shows us was that there were all kinds of little religious effigies in common use in Israel throughout the period of the kings. Now, within this eighth chapter, we have Tammuz, which was a Babylonian god. We have reference to other gods being worshipped there right in the temple precincts. we have this image, and we spoke about this at some length on the first talk on the subject, that the men of Israel were looking towards the rising sun in the temple courtyard. And we pointed out, and the words are actually there in this eighth chapter, that they had their backs to the sanctuary and they were looking at the rising sun. And as we pointed out, they had deliberately turned their back on God to look at the sun as it rose. We're worshiping the sun. Now, I think I'm going to change the order of things a little bit. So I thought about this driving in the car. I think what we will do is go to 2 Kings 23 for a minute. We spent quite a bit of time with 1 and 2 Kings in the first couple of talks on this subject. And the point that we made there repeatedly is that it was not a new thing, all of these different religious items being found within the temple. It was by no means new. We pointed out that it's entirely possible that all this had started in the time of Solomon, that Solomon gathered together a whole series of different wives, and he did this for political purposes, but each of the different wives brought their own way of life with them. They brought their own religion. He built them houses, is the phrase, and those were probably more like small palaces. And within those palaces would have been, even though we have no direct evidence for this, in those small palaces would almost certainly have been little shrines to the gods that they had when they were back home. So, now, I want to look particularly at verse 9 in this second book of Kings, chapter 23. We're looking at the time of Josiah here. We're looking at all of the different things that were broken down, the high places, the groves and so forth, the idols which were smashed, and the things that were burnt that belonged to the various religions throughout Judea generally. But verse 9, nevertheless, the priests of the high places came not up to the altar of the Lord in Jerusalem, but they did eat of the unleavened bread among their brethren. What does that mean? Does it mean that the priests of Baal, if we want to go back to another circumstance, think of Ahab and Jezebel. Now, Jezebel, we're not told what she brought with her, but she certainly brought something with her into Abraham's court. She certainly brought a way of life. If she was anything like the priest, the princesses who were married to foreign kings from that period, she brought a whole way of life with her. Furnishings, religious motifs, priests to serve in the little shrine that she had, and personal servants. She would almost certainly have done that if she followed the pattern that was in vogue in that era. Now you have to ask yourself, what's so different about what the Canaanite priests did to what the Levitical priests did? And the answer is not a great deal. They all dressed for the occasion. They all had particular clothes that belonged to their priestly office, whether it was a Jewish priest, whether it was a Levite, or whether it was a Canaanite priest of Baal. You could recognize them from what they wore. They all performed animal sacrifices, probably a little differently, but it's not so different when you're an accomplished and a well-skilled butcher to change your procedure a little bit. If you're asked to. The incense censers were a little bit different shape, depending on the time that they were made, and depending on the circumstances and the place where they were formed, but the way they were used was much the same. It was a small step for a Levite to go from the service of the temple to the service of something like Jezebel's god, in Jezebel's offering. Now, was that what was happening? I suspect that it was. And this little phrase here in this ninth verse of 2 Kings 23 indicates that all these priests ate a common meal. The priests were supported by the offerings of the people under the Levitical system. They were all entitled to that support, to whatever those offerings came. That was their portion under Moses. And it looks as if whether the priests were serving the God of Israel or whether they were serving some other God, that they all shared what was brought to support the Levites. Now, why do I think that's the case? If you look in Ezekiel 44, I'm not going to look it up, but if you want to scan it while we're talking, go ahead. It's around verse 10. There's about half a dozen verses that start somewhere around verse 8 or 10. And what it talks about there are Levites who performed idolatrous acts. Levites who performed idolatrous acts. But, said Ezekiel, it didn't really matter what they did in the past, however many things they had done in the past. There would be a day when God would make sure that what was done in God's service was done the way God wanted them to. And that's repeated twice. Despite what the priests may have done in the past in the way of idolatrous functions, in Ezekiel 44, there would be a day when God would sort all these things out. So, I bring this up because, and in previous times, we talked quite a bit about what had gone on in the temple, and it's quite possible that in the roof of the temple, there were items which belonged in those high places, in those groves. If you read the book of Kings carefully, it seems to be that way. And if you look at what Ezekiel says about what was in the temple, it's almost certain that there were many things incorporated into temple worship which had nothing to do with the God of Israel. Nothing to do with the God of Israel. And yet they were all priests. They were probably all Levites. They were probably all doing these same things. Now, a couple of talks ago, we picked up many of the social issues which are here in today's world and indicated that these things are all there. They were there in Ezekiel's day. And the phrase that I used repeatedly in that previous talk was, the more things change, the more they stay the same. Ezekiel was dealing with the same social issues that we deal with today. This question of how women fitted into the priesthood, we talked about that quite a bit last time. But what I want to raise for your consideration today is this idea that the religions consider that religious leaders consider that all religions are equivalent. They all are on equal footing, and they all need to be considered as worthwhile social enterprises. That's a modern way of looking at it. But surely that's what was meant by the Levites which performed idolatrous acts. Surely that's what was meant in the time of Josiah, when the priests, whatever they had been doing during the day, all sat down in the evening and enjoyed a common meal. Now, when we get to the next few chapters in Ezekiel 9, 10, 11, we find the Spirit of God sort of moving from the holy place, rising up and sort of looking at what was going on in the temple, moving, not quite sure what to do, it seems, almost, should I stay, is it worth staying, not, and that almost seems to be what's happening. It's a pity to put anthropomorphic ideas like that into the mind of God, but that seems to be what's happening. And then finally, the Spirit of God moved and went out onto the mountain, which was toward the east. Went out to the Mount of Olives, as we would think of it today. And left. Left through the east gate. The gate which was reserved later for the prince. Which was the main entrance which the priests used when they came into the temple. And moved further and further westward towards the holy place. Now, think for a minute of those 24 men of the nation of Israel who were in the court of the side of the temple, who were looking to see the rising sun, to see the sun rise over the Mount of Olives. And think that that was the way God left. Isaiah says they have eyes, but they can't see. Ears they can't hear and so forth. If they could see, if those 24 men could see, they would have seen God leave. But they didn't. But they didn't. Chapter 12. Son of man, you dwell in a rebellious... Son of man, thou dwellest in the midst of a rebellious house. It says in the first verse of chapter 12. In verse 19 of chapter 12, there's a little word. Oh, it's a big word. It's the word violence. It's the word violence. People of the land, thus say the Lord God, the inhabitants of Jerusalem and the land of Israel, they shall eat their bread with carefulness and drink their water with astonishment, that her land may be desolate from all that is therein, because of the violence of all them that dwell therein, and the cities that are inhabited shall be laid waste. It's interesting, isn't it? If you look at the violence which is going on, that's not the violence which actually lays the cities waste later. It's because there was violence that the cities were destroyed by the Babylonians. How did all this happen? And what do we mean by the word violence? Well, it would be interesting. We're not going to spend a lot of time with it now, but it's interesting to do a word study and work your way through the Old Testament with this word violence. And certainly it does mean that people use their fists against others now and again, or something worse than that occasionally. There certainly is the concept of physical violence there when the word is used. But that's not always the case, and I don't think that's the case here. If you look at the description of what's going on, it's that God's way of life has been violated. The violence has been against God's law. The violence was toward God. It was not physical violence toward other people. In this circumstance, certainly. And there are plenty of other places where it's more than likely the case. We talk about the word violence in the days of Noah. And yet there's no evidence either within that section in Genesis or within the later comments that Jesus made that violence was actually there. But what was there was that God's way of life had been destroyed. And that surely is a violent act. That's what we're talking about here. That's what Ezekiel keeps coming back to. You have destroyed a way of life. You have removed the blessings that God offered for you. How did they do it, and why did they do it, and what was going on? Well, look at verse 1 of chapter 13. Here, Son of man, prophesy against the prophets of Israel, that prophesy and say unto them that prophesy out of their own hearts. You foolish prophets, he says in the verse 3. Again in verse 8 and 10. They're seduced by things that they want to hear. They've been told things that they like to hear. Canadian politics is full of that. Chrétien could talk a blue streak. And he told us a lot of things that everybody wanted to hear. And yet when you look at what happened in the 12 years that he was there, there's very little actually been accomplished. Or maybe it's a good thing. I'm not going to say it was either good or bad. But that's what we have here. Somebody who can talk a good line, make you think things are going well, and you just flow along with what's happening. That was what was going on, and that was what Ezekiel stood against. These smooth words, we have that phrase in the Old Testament in a number of places. These smooth words. Let's skip verse chapter 14. Yeah, the 14, 15, 16 are interesting, but let's go now to chapter 17, which was the one that was read, and where I want to actually start, even though we've been going for about 15 minutes, where I want to actually start tonight's talk. So once again, Ezekiel was assured that wherever he was and under whatever circumstances, if he would only listen, God was there for him. If he would look for God, God had not deserted Ezekiel. He would not, whatever circumstances he found himself in. The people that had surrounded him had a very different view of things. And they looked upon life as being an easy and a simple and an interesting thing which was going on, and let's just keep the good times flowing. This little parable, which we have here in chapter 17, is an exact play of the history that was going on at this time. Some of what's in this parable had happened. Some of it was happening when Ezekiel was there in Babylon, in the particular time that he was there, and some of it was about to happen. There was a tree in Lebanon, cedar of Lebanon, and along came a great eagle, took what was probably the leader from that cedar, took it away and planted it somewhere else. He didn't just take the eagle, didn't just take the leader, didn't just take a twig or two, but he also took seed from this tree. So he took more than just the top two or three choicest shoots. He also took seed from the tree so that he could grow new trees wherever he was, wherever he took them to. And the tree started to grow in its new surroundings. And then came another large eagle. And the tree that was growing from this replanted shoot saw the new eagle coming, big eagle, and said, well, maybe I should attach myself to it. And the story of the and the language in the parable here is that the tree leaned its roots and its branches towards this eagle. But then the parable ends with a very devastating view of what happened to that tree, regardless of which eagle the tree played up to. Didn't help the tree at all. It was still destroyed. So what was going on? What was the message? And why was it so important? Well, as it happens, I've given this particular section of this talk about five times in the last couple of months. So bear with me if you missed some of it or if you've heard much of it before. The during the later years of the time of the kings in Judea, the Egyptians gradually increased their sphere of influence. As the Assyrian Empire dried up, it didn't collapse immediately. The Assyrian Empire sort of shrank from the sides and then collapsed. It collapsed internally more than anything. And it was this collapse which allowed the Egyptians to push up along the Mediterranean coast into what is present-day Lebanon, out towards Syria, and over into the region around the River Jordan, and beyond that to some extent. And then the Babylonian Empire started to grow. Now, Carchemish is in present-day Syria, and the Babylonian and the Egyptian armies met at Carchemish. It's a very famous battle in ancient history. And both sides were really severely damaged. But the Babylonians came out on the winning side. And they then expanded their influence down into the Mediterranean. And they took over the area which included Judea. Egypt shrank all the way back into its present-day borders, more or less. So that was how Nebuchadnezzar came to be in control. His army was damaged, but it was certainly in much better condition than the Egyptians, and so he established a firm control over Judea, present-day Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, down through Saudi Arabia, and back all the way into the Tigris-Euphrates Valley. The Babylonian Empire was just about at its zenith at that point. Well, the Egyptians didn't want to lose that territory. So about 3 years later, their army got together and they came back up against the Babylonians. At that time, there was a real standoff. Both armies were so severely mauled that Nebuchadnezzar had to go back, and Nebuchadnezzar wasn't able to mount a military campaign for another 2 years. And even then, he sort of gradually worked his way back, and he did not come on these regular annual pilgrimages almost to his territory to collect the taxes that he later came to be the fort of the Babylonian Empire. So you see what had happened. The Babylonians were pushed back. The army had to regroup. The Egyptians appeared a good bet because they were the closest. That was what is going on here with the eagles. The eagle came, took the branch from the top of the tree. The princes, the best in the land. We have, within the Babylonian Chronicles, we have the rations that Jehoiakim was given. We know he was there. We know he was in prison. We also have within these chronicles lists of princes, lists of ordinary people. There is, for instance, the name of a gardener who was from Judea. Who were taken there because they had particular skills, these people, and they were used in Babylon. We know they went. You see, the best tradespeople, the leaders, the military people, they all were taken to Babylon. The top of the tree, the best the tree could offer, was taken. When the Egyptian army met the Nebuchadnezzar for the second time, and the two armies then had to part, severely destroyed, the Jews began to think, well, maybe Egypt is a better bet than Babylon. That was where the tree reached its branches toward the next eagle. But it made no difference. It made no difference. Eventually, the nation of Judea was trodden down completely by the Babylonian army. That's what this talks about. Well, why does this step us into today? Because when you look at the last four verses of the 17th chapter, the same thing is repeated, but repeated with a little difference. There it says that God will take the tip from the best tree. God will take a prince. God will raise a prince from out of this tree which represents Israel. And God will set that prince in a land that God determines. And then that tree will flourish. That nation will flourish. Now, certainly this happened when they went back under the Persians. But we know that that wasn't the real fulfillment of this. What we're really talking about here is the prince which was to come. The prince which would eventually enter the temple through the east gate. The prince of the house of Judah, which would not be born for another 600 years, approximately. And the one that we still look forward to. So you see, we're looking at the question of history repeating itself. We're looking at this matter that the things people do that they did in Ezekiel's day, they're still doing today. God didn't approve of what went on in Judea in Ezekiel's day. God doesn't approve of the things which are going on in Canada, for instance, in our day. He can't do, because God doesn't change. But there will be a time when the prince will come that God appoints, and that prince will set things right. The restitution of all things is the phrase in the Acts. Okay. Now, we said at the start that things are structured in a very sensible way, let's say. The prophecy unfolds in a very reasonable way. You see, we've gone over what had been happening And there had been a whole series of warnings and play acting and so forth, which demonstrated what was going, what had happened in Babylon, in Jerusalem at that time, to get those people to Babylon, what was going on and what would continue to go on there, and they could watch it happen. We went through this 17th chapter where they could see the history unfolding. When Ezekiel was speaking these words, this question of the second eagle coming was being resolved. Ezekiel gives us his timeline as he works all the way through this prophecy. The first eagle had done its job. The second eagle was doing its job and was about to be pushed back. That was what was happening when Ezekiel spoke those words. Now we come in the 18th chapter to a parable. The fathers have eaten sour grapes, and the children's teeth are set on edge. Why go to that point? Why pick up something like that? And yet, if you keep on reading, you see that what the point is made there is that this was not what was going to be said from now on. Why raise that parable anyway? Because it was so easy to think that what was happening to that nation was because people in the time of Josiah hadn't cleaned things up properly. We looked at that phrase a few minutes ago. It was so easy to think that when you go all the way back to King Asa, that reform didn't work, and any of the others. It's so easy to blame the past. It's so easy to blame someone else. The priests, and we've indicated to you that it was almost certainly the whole Levitical priesthood which was doing Baal worship as well as the worship of Jehovah, of Yahweh. Almost certainly so. So it's so easy to fall back and say, well, I couldn't help it. It wasn't my fault. The leaders, the bosses, everybody did it. I didn't do it. Not my fault. I think that's the reason that we step from the 17th chapter to the 18th chapter. It's so easy to say big forces are at work. It's so easy to say those big forces are at work because the priests messed up. Everybody messed up. Behold, all souls are mine, the fourth verse. As the soul of the Father, so also the soul of the Son is mine. The soul that sinneth, it shall die. But if a man be just and do which is lawful and right, and then we have in the next four or five verses a whole sequence of things. If he doesn't do all of those things, end of the ninth verse, he shall surely live. And then from verse 10 down to, where are we? End of 18. That if you do all these bad things, you will certainly bear the iniquity for that and die, as it says in verse 19. The soul that sinneth, it's repeated again in verse 20. It shall die. The son shall not bear the iniquity of the father. All the transgressions that he hath committed in the 22nd verse, in his righteousness that he hath done, he shall live. If he turns away from those various transgressions in the 21st verse. And down into the 25th verse, then say ye, the way of the Lord is not equal. Why can you say the way of the Lord is not equal? When it's what you have done, what you as an individual did, which is bringing about what's here. Now, we raised another point a couple of talks ago when we looked at these verses in more detail. Does this chapter, I'll just raise it for you as a question. Does this chapter presage resurrection? We very often say that resurrection isn't preached in the Old Testament. There's just two or three little places, a couple in the Psalms, the one in Job is one of the most famous, and so forth. Does this chapter mean resurrection? What does it mean? Under those circumstances, you'll die. Under these circumstances, you will live. And when we compare that with coming out of the 17th chapter, where we're looking forward to the time of Christ, does this chapter preach resurrection? There's enough of that. It's something for you to think about sometime. 19 and 20, I want to look at a verse in chapter 20, verse 13 in chapter 20. But the house of Israel rebelled against me in the wilderness. They walked not in my statutes. They despised my judgments, which if a man do, he shall even live in them. And my Sabbaths they greatly polluted. If a man do, he shall even live in them, my statutes. You see, it was a way of life. It was a way of life in Moses that they had been offered. The last verse, I just take my glasses off, I can't see the number, the last verse in the bottom of my page talks about this land of milk and honey that they were taken into. You see, they were given the physical things. And they were promised that if they ordered their lives in a certain way, that they would be comfortable and happy. All of those things were guaranteed under Moses. A way of life. And that's what they had let go for all kinds of ecumenical, all kinds of social, all kinds of other reasons. The end of verse, end of chapter 20, our Lord God, they say, I speak in parables. Now, I've lost a little section here that I want to talk about. I've lost a couple of phrases, got to find them. Ah, yeah. Chapter 22. Think back for a minute to the law of Moses. Think back for a few minutes to the way this law functioned, the way it operated. The people went into a new land, and they were told that they would each be given a part of that land. And that parcel of land that they were to receive would be enough to support them and their family. They were also told that there was to be a religious system in place. And the Levites were given Levitical cities and so forth, and there was a structure to their society promised in Moses. Now think for a few minutes about the tabernacle and what it was constructed of. There was wood in it, there were various fabrics, there were skins, there were all kinds of things like that. There was not a lot of metal, but there was metal there. And think also of the sort of things that people had with them when they lived a pastoral existence, when they took herds with them and they moved from place to place. And think also of the fact that because they had been in Egypt, there were some in their company that had metalworking skills and techniques of that nature at their disposal. So, you see, the tabernacle could be constructed with things that were just about taken off their back, things that they would have with them, things that they could gather quite easily, and things which they could accumulate and bring together to make that structure. As I was thinking about this, it just occurred to me that many years ago, in the early 1950s, we built a first hall in this city, on the corner of King's Road and Blanchard. When we had actually got through all the discussion in the meeting about whether we should build a hall or not, we finally set to work. What happened was that we had in our company at that time everything but a plumber. And so we did practically all the work on the King's Road Hall. Brethren that were there. We had people who were very familiar with construction techniques. We had the painters, the finishing people. Clyde's uncle did the roof for us, Sam Snoblin. And, you know, we could lay our hands on practically everything that was needed there. In those days, they used to say that 60% of the cost of building a hall was in the labor that went into it. 40% was in materials. Well, it also happened that Grace Salisbury's family ran Drysdale Sash and Door. So we were able to get even things like that at a comfortable discount. We built the hall because we had the talent in the meeting at that time. We didn't need the volume of money that we seem to need nowadays to do things. And regulations were different then as well. It was easier to do things that way in those days. That's what you're looking at with the construction of the tabernacle. They had everything they needed to build the tabernacle, either on their backs or with the skills that they had in their hands. Now, step ahead to the time when Solomon built the temple. He had to train people as stonemasons. He had to import laborers. He imported materials. He taxed the people rather heavily to finish the temple to that standard. You see, now you're into property management. Now you're into money. Now you're into financial services and all of those things that go with a compound structure. And if we had read a little bit more in that chapter which we looked at for the priests that sat together and ate their meal together, we would have seen that the temple in those days was in a serious state of disrepair. But we would also see, if you keep on reading in that chapter, that there was money in the temple coffers. It just hadn't been spent on maintaining the temple. Why raise all these issues? Because the temple in Ezekiel's day, and we know this very clearly from Josephus' writing and Philo's writing in the time of Christ, the temple was the financial center. There was a temple tax in those days. You paid your money. That was different than what had happened and had been intended in Moses' day. You had a farm. You provided things which would support the priests. If you needed new skins to cover the holy place, they could be obtained. You didn't have to give money. The financial tax stayed the same. But if you had a bad crop, the priests also got less. Everybody got less. Everybody had to make do if the crop went down. But as soon as you start building structures and need money to run them, the tax keeps going on and on and on. Now, we know from Josephus' writings that the priests actually held a lot of mortgages on people's houses. And this is probably what Jesus meant when he said, you devour widows' houses and for a pretext make long prayers. They probably... And we know that they were foreclosing on mortgages quite regularly, the priests. And we also know that the priests then took the land which they gathered after they had foreclosed on these mortgages and built, particularly if it was in a nice area like the shores of the Dead Sea, they built themselves a nice winter palace down there. There are several of them, and one or two interesting scrolls have been discovered in some of these palaces which were built on land which had almost certainly been taken over illegally. Why say all this? Why say all this? Well, the answer's here in chapter 22. Behold, in the sixth verse, the princes of Israel, everyone in the, were in the, to their power to shed blood. In thee have they set light by father and mother. In the midst of thee have they dealt by the oppression with the stranger. In thee have they vexed the fatherless and the widow. They've despised my holy things and hath profaned my Sabbaths. They've despised my holy things and profaned my Sabbaths. The intention in Moses was that everyone should have a share. Behold, in the 13th verse, therefore I have smitten my hand at thy dishonest gain. At thy dishonest gain. The phrase is also there in chapter 20, in verse 27. Dishonest gain. It seems that the financial dealings of the priesthood had been going on for a lot longer than we read of in Josephus' time. That the violence which was being perpetrated in the land in many instances was financial, more and physical. The way of life had been destroyed. Let's look very quickly at a couple of verses in chapter 24, and then we'll move on to the other two chapters that I do want to deal with this evening. Chapter 24, starting in verse 15. The situation that we read there in the next five verses is that Ezekiel was told to continue his preaching activities in spite of the fact that his wife died. He was not given time to mourn the loss of his wife. Now, that must have been a terrible thing for someone in Ezekiel's position. This was probably the one thing that he had left beside his faith and he could hold on to in the land that he had been taken to as a captive. He lost his wife. Now, why was his wife taken away from him? The answer is in the last three or four verses of this 24th chapter. Starting in verse 24, "Thus Ezekiel is unto you a sign, according to all that he hath done shall ye do. And when this cometh, ye shall know that I am the Lord God." Everything that Ezekiel had said, all of the little charades that he had played, he cut his hair, you remember, separated it into three pieces, and each piece had a meaning. That was one of the things. He made a little model of the temple and the surrounding city and showed what would happen to it. All of these things that Ezekiel had said, all of the things that he did to show them what was happening, were done so that they should realize that I am the Lord God. "Also, thou son of man, shall it not be in the day when I take from them their strength, the joy of their glory, the desire of their eyes, and that whereupon they set their minds, their sons and their daughters, that he that escapeth in that day shall come unto thee to cause thee to hear it with thine ears. In that day shall thy mouth be opened to him which is escaped, and thou shalt speak, no more be dumb. Thou shalt be a sign unto them, and they shall know that I am the Lord." And this is the end of the first half. Ezekiel is really split into two halves. This is the end of the first half. It ends on those verses and those notes that that what had been done was to show these people that their lives had been misspent. And because of it, they were in the situation that they found themselves in Babylon. So, where do we go from here? Well, we turn around and look at the nations round about. One of the first countries that they look at is the Amorites. And we're not going to spend any time with the Amorites. We're going to move on over to the 26th chapter. Because the intent of the prophecy now is changing. We've gone in detail through what was happening in Israel at that time and what would happen over the next very few years to them to finish off the nation of Judea until the under the Persians, under Ezra and Nehemiah, the people returned to rebuild their city. But the prophecy now changes emphasis, and looks at the nations round about, the situation round about. Now, it's interesting when you get a little older and you sort of think about what's gone on in Christadelphian communities over the years. It's interesting how things change as they go by. There was a time when you could almost never hear a Christadelphian lecture without either having something from this 25th chapter of Ezekiel, or the one which we're going to look at in a few minutes' time, a few chapters further on. I remember when we first got to Victoria that we went to see this parade in Queen Victoria's birthday, you know, the 24th of May, May Day parade. And lo and behold, there was a float in that parade from the nation of Israel. Israel had just proclaimed itself an independent state. The United Nations had guaranteed Israel an existence. The Arab War was not over by that means, by any certainty, when that float was in the parade. But there was hope for a nation of Israel, and it was expressed by a float in the Victoria Day Parade in the first summer when we got out here to Canada. Why bring that up? Because one of the things that was mentioned so frequently in Christadelphian lectures in that time were these next four or five verses from this 26th chapter of Ezekiel. Verse 2, Son of Man, because that Tyrus has said against Jerusalem, aha, she's broken. That was the gates of the people. She's turned unto me, I shall be replenished. Now she's laid waste. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, behold, I am against thee, O Tyrus, and will cause many nations to come up against thee, as the sea causeth his waves to come up. They shall destroy the walls of Tyre, break down her towers, and I will also scrape her dust from her and make her like the top of a rock. It shall be a place for the spreading of nets in the midst of the sea, for I have spoken it, saith the Lord God, and it shall become a spoil to the nations. Seventh verse, for thus saith the Lord God, I will bring up Nebuchadnezzar. And if you read on down through there, he will bring them siege engines and so forth and destroy the city. And that was what happened. Because after Nebuchadnezzar had consolidated, after he had defeated the Egyptian army for the second time, then he set about consolidating his grip on the Middle East. Syria was no problem. The area that we now think of as Jordan was just overrun very quickly. Judea was taken also quite quickly. There were two problems on the coast as they went down the coast towards Egypt. Two problems. One was Tyre, and the other was a city which is in the site of present-day Gaza. So what happened with Tyre? Well, it was destroyed. But quite interestingly, the inhabitants decided that the best thing they could do was to move their city, and they moved it to an island offshore. And 40 years ago, Christadelphian lecturers would tell this story continuously and regularly. They moved the city of Tyre onto a little island. The city was moved all right. Nebuchadnezzar broke down the old one. He then controlled the whole of the Levant. And that was what he wanted. And he just left them in their little island to trade back and forth with their ships in the Mediterranean. There's a story in there, if you look on down, about the siege engines that were brought against the city. There's a story in there of scraping the dust, of making it like the top of a rock, cleaning the whole thing down. It wasn't until we got to Alexander the Great that that was fulfilled. Alexander took the ruins of the walls and made a causeway across from the mainland to the island. He filled the holes between the rocks with the small debris and even the scrapings off the rocks so that he had a smooth passageway across. Now, why did he want a smooth passageway across there? Because they constructed siege engines, and some of these siege engines were 120 feet tall. And they were on rather shaky wheels in those days, but they shoved them along across this causeway, and then they could fire down from great heights on the inhabitants who were trying to defend Tyre. And none of our members have been into Lebanon for a long time and for obvious reasons, but there was an old brother, Brother George McAdams, that got there a number of years ago, and he just loved to show his slides of the rock that had been the original site of the city of Tyre. It was used to dry fishermen's nets. It was used for that purpose because it was clean and smooth, and the sun would beat down on the nets and dry them very quickly. But no soil, no plants, nothing. You just spread your nets on this nice sun-catching rock. You see, we go very easily from the time of Ezekiel into the present day. We go very easily when we look at the way these prophecies work out from the past to the present. And we're reminded of why those things happened. Because these people, all of them, had a way of life which was distinctly different from the way of life that God offered. 36th chapter of Ezekiel. We'll spend a few minutes with this, then we'll sit down. Sixth verse, Ezekiel 36. Prophesy therefore concerning the land of Israel, and say unto the mountains, and to the hills, to the rivers, to the valleys, thus saith the Lord God, because I have spoken in my jealousy and in my fury, because ye have borne the shame of the heathen. Therefore, thus saith the Lord God, I have lifted up mine hand, and surely the heathen that are about you, they shall bear their shame. Why? Moreover, the word of the Lord, verse 16, came unto me, son of man, when the house of Israel dwelt in their own land, they defiled it. 19th verse, and I scattered them among the heathen, and they were dispersed throughout all countries. 21st verse, but I had pity for my holy name, which the house of Israel has profaned among the heathen. I do not this for your sakes, in the middle of the 22nd verse, O house of Israel, but for my holy name's sake, which ye have profaned among the heathen, whither ye went. I will sanctify my great name, which was profaned among the heathen, which ye have profaned in the midst of them. For in the 24th verse, for I will take you from among the heathen, gather you out of all countries, and will bring you into your own land. It happened with the Persians, but the Romans put a stop to that. It's happening again. And it will be interesting to watch. And many of us, we have been watching, haven't we? Since the time when that float was in the Victoria Day Parade, and 50 years ago now. Then will I sprinkle clean water, and ye shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers. This is verse 28. Ye shall dwell in the land that I gave to your fathers. Chapter 37 contains, again, this was something that you used to hear regularly in lectures many years ago. It contains, one, the illustration of the Valley of Dry Bones. And then it contains also this image of two sticks. And Ezekiel brings up that matter. Two sticks, two parts to the nation of Israel. The one stick which represented the Israeli kingdom. And the other which represented the Judean kingdom. And then, as Ezekiel said, there will come a day when the two sticks will be brought together and will be one stick yet again. The nation will be made whole yet again. There will come a day, but we haven't seen that day yet. So you see, Ezekiel is giving us these little hints at what's going to happen. And when we stand here nowadays and look at that nation of Israel struggling to survive, we can say, things are happening. Things are happening. What Ezekiel said, and now it's 2,500 years ago, they are gradually unraveling. Look at the dry bones for just an instant. Son of man, can these bones live? Can these bones live? Now, there are a lot of these, and I don't know whether you appreciate my saying things this way, but I've said it on a number of occasions in the past from platforms like this. There are a lot of stupid statements in the Bible. Can these bones live? you couldn't even extract DNA from them. We can do things like that nowadays. They were bone dry, as we say. There was no life whatsoever in that pile of bones which Ezekiel saw. But Ezekiel didn't say what I said. Ezekiel didn't react the way I did. Why are you asking me such a stupid question? Ezekiel didn't say anything remotely like that. Ezekiel said essentially what he did when that first vision came down to him by the river Kibar. And when I saw, said Ezekiel, I fell on my face. There was respect for the fact that God was with him. There was respect for the fact that God had a lot more capability than the people who he had captured him thought. There was respect for the fact that God was in control even in Babylon. And here there is respect for the fact that God knows more than we do. And God is capable of much more than we are capable of. And that's what Ezekiel said and expressed and acknowledged in his response. He said, in so many words, I don't know God, but you do. Can these bones live? You're the only one that knows that, God. And gradually, the bones did come together. And in the land that had been promised to the children of Israel, the bones are reuniting, and they're reuniting now. And we see before us things that belong in our day and age. And as we have said, we see also all the same social problems which were in Ezekiel's day in our society. But in the midst of this mass of social issues which we humans enjoy so much, the dry bones are coming together. Now, I have one more. I'm sort of wondering whether I should ask for yet another, because there's quite a lot to talk about if you get into what the imagery means in chapter 1. If we want to spend any time with the temple, which is there later on. So I haven't quite decided what's going to come in the next talk, which is in about a month's time. But we will certainly get to some of the symbolism which is there in chapter 1 and chapter 3.